Hello.
Hello.
Greetings.
I think you mean greasings.
I don't. That's stupid.
Oh, now fine, we're getting judgy.
Yes. We're very judgmental about other people's cultures and their priorities on honor and things and stuff. Whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Joe, you know what episode this is?
This is 300.
It is, and you know, being the skilled marketers that we are, and the brainiacs behind this wonderful podcast that everyone loves, we decided that we would do something special for our 300th episode, something very special and unique, and not at all the first thing that we thought of.
No, definitely not. But we're talking about the movie 300. We had previously, I think, dismissed this movie on more than one occasion, but I can't recall on the occasions or if that's actually true. But this is a movie that I saw when it came out, and my recollection was I saw it in college, but it did not get released then. So I must
it's just a very college movie.
Yeah, I saw it after that. This is a movie from December 9th, 2006. If you were in college at the time or you weren't born yet, I don't want to hear about it. That's just, I was out of college. That's all I got to say.
Mm.
Yeah. Dan, I believe you were perhaps in college still.
No, I was, I had a job.
Oh, you
I
had a job.
Working. I was working at a large technology company in 2006.
Mm.
I was still partially in college. I don't know. I didn't, my college just kind of like faded out, just behind the scenes. I didn't really like finish or stuff. It just kind of went away eventually.
Yeah. Well, this is a very bro-y, adolescent movie. It's not smart. Were
yeah, no.
Good.
2006 though. I did a little bit of Googling because I was curious what else was going on in 2006 when it came to movies, and I discovered that this was the year of Casino Royale. Not a bad movie. Ricky Bobby movie was in there. Whatever that's called. Is it called Ricky Bobby? It's
no,
not Ricky
Talladega Nights.
Talladega Nights. Yeah. That happened in 2006. I think that's on par with the level of intelligence that we're really leaning into here. Although The Departed was 2006, so that's a good movie, I guess.
Yeah, but they had that rat at the end, you know, you could have had digitally removed if you really like cared about cinema, I guess. But
you kickstart something like that if you really wanted to.
But I don't know. I don't know. I think there was maybe perhaps something in the water or something in the culture or something like people just were not discerning enough.
Yeah, I don't want to say, I mean, I have a skewed perspective, obviously, because I was in my early 20s when this came out, but I feel like we had a lower bar for action movies and, you know, things in general. I mean, you know, there were still always, like, arty movies, but, you know, and this was the era that we were pivoting to graphic novels as the underlying source for a lot of things. Just make them, you know, gritty and hardcore and very stylized and... a new cast of directors was coming out and doing their thing and putting a lot of, you know, they really turned those dials up to 11 on a lot of things. And they were trying stuff. So, you know, they got a really long leash for a little while. And, this movie, in both my memory and I think in revisiting this in our discussions, I've said it a few times to you privately, but this movie was a milestone. It was not really a high water mark, more of a low water mark, whatever. It was a watermark of sorts on the side of a mountain where you know, it really planted a flag and said, like, look what we can do here. We can take a graphic novel. We can stylize the bejesus out of it. We can make it, you know, hyper-masculine and violent, and it can really sort of capture an imagination of an audience goer that would be showing them things that they haven't seen before. It's kind of like if you grew up in, like a nice... household that like prevented you from drinking soda until you were like 15, and then suddenly you had like a Coke, and then you were just like, oh my god, I didn't realize that the flavors could be turned up this high. Like, it's kind of that feeling for a movie, for an action movie, which is, you know, whatever. Like, they're not making you feel more deeply than you've ever felt before. They're just like hitting you in the face with visuals and violence that you've never seen before. But it, you know, they did some interesting stuff in this movie for 2006, which was repeated poorly in the years to come. And then it was parodied even more poorly in the years to come. And then I think we sort of flamed out on the graphic novel a little bit, and we sort of pivoted that into comics and DC Marvel stuff. And, you know, some people kind of dragged this style kicking and screaming into that DC. But yeah, this was a period of time which feels like we're past it now, even though it was, you know, the far flung ages of 14 years ago. But yeah, it's a thing. It's a time capsule.
Yeah, I mean, it's curious you say DC and not like Zack Snyder, because I feel like
I'm talking about Zack Snyder. I lump it into DC because he's kind of the biggest name of DC right now, isn't he? Still has been for a while.
Yeah, I mean, he has ebbed and flowed with DC over the years. He was out of popularity, and now he's back in popularity. But the way he's back in popularity is because of the so-called Zack Snyder cut of the Justice League movie, a movie he was overseeing, and then unfortunately, one of his children passed away, and he decided that he was going to step away, and Joss Whedon finished the movie, and then Zack Snyder, over the however many years, just kept inching forwards, saying that there was actually a good version of the movie, and that it existed, and it was real, and it was on film, and that he just had to show it, and he needed authorization from DC to show it, and it turns out that's, of course, absolutely not true. The movie was not finished the way that he wanted it, and that it will be released as a four-part miniseries on HBO Max, which is not what you might think of as the Zack Snyder cut of the movie of Justice League. It is something you might think of as Zack Snyder is revisiting something he made partially at one point and turning it into something else later. And some of that will be in response to the decisions that were made by the director who stepped in for him. So he's had a very complicated relationship with Warner Brothers. And this is, of course, his first comic book movie, 300, and then he would go on to do Watchmen before he would do Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. What a catastrophe that was. And then Justice League.
At least the Justice Sun finally came up, and we can just get on to having Justice Daytime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this movie is probably what I used to think of as the artsy one, I guess, in my mind, because I had omitted or burned out, cauterized from my brain, all of the other awful stuff that's in here.
Well, I mean, part of his mission was to make sort of a shot-for-shot recreation of the graphic novel itself, which, you know, Frank Miller has his very heavily stylized stuff that he's got going on.
Yeah, and he received a lot of flack for that for when he did Watchmen. He had a lot of shot-for-shot reproductions of panels from Dave Gibbons' drawings for Watchmen in the movie. And a lot of people felt like it adhered too closely to trying to frame things and be a certain way to visually to fit into that rubric rather than be a film. And I believe there were some complaints along those lines for this one, but I think this movie, you know, since it was not as, I would say probably not as widely regarded of a graphic novel as Watchmen, 300 is another graphic novel by Frank Miller, who is himself his own controversial figure. Yeah, it's...
Because of the hats?
He's not so great. Just like, do a Google search on him.
Feel like I don't need to.
No, he could be a better human being, is all I'm saying. But
I mean, we all could.
Yeah, I mean,
saying you're better than everyone. You're saying you're better than Frank Miller.
Well, I mean, I'm obviously not better than Frank Miller. I'm just more judgmental about Frank Miller than Frank Miller is, I guess. But he is. He's got his own little things that he's got going on, and Zack Snyder is making this, now Frank Miller would go on to participate in Sin City and then The Spirit, their own graphic novel as movie kind of esque things, spawned off of this sort of hyper stylized approach to rendering something that seemed illustrated in a way that would appear to be photographic. That is not always successful, either in this movie or in the other movies I've mentioned. Mainly,
but
because
you have to admit, for a period of time, like the Sin City look, where like some of those frames were like completely black and white, hard contrast, sort of like storyboard frame looking things, it was actually really cool to see that, because you're like, wow, nobody's ever really done that before, and look at this.
I don't know if I have to admit that.
Admit it now. Go on the record.
No, I refuse.
Take the plea deal.
Are you holding me in contempt? It never really fully caught on for me, because it always felt a little disjointed. It never really felt like it was a 3D world that you were in. It always felt like you were looking at a 2.5D world. And this movie at some point suffers from the same sorts of things, where you see things like the infamous shot of the tree with all of the bodies of slain townspeople stuck to it, and you're pulling out through all the Spartans, and everything just seems like one of those collages, one of those photo collages where they took an old-timey 1890s like lithographic whatever shot of something, and then they cut out everybody and painted out the stuff, and then they did like a parallax thing. That's what it seems like. It doesn't really read as like you're living in this world that is illustrated. It reads like you are looking at selected illustrations that have been moved about in a sort of like diorama way.
What about that really cool shot of the silhouetted pushing the guys off the cliff with the sun behind him?
You're right. That looked really 3D, the way that everything was just sort of sliding in one plane.
I mean, it was new. It was interesting. It was kind of cool looking in places. Like, it was certainly something that hadn't been done before, and they were pushing limits. I know what you're saying. It's flat sometimes.
Yeah, it doesn't hold up super well, just visually, on a visual level. Also, the quality of the effects work that's here. For the studios who were working on it, this was a big deal. However, again, this does not age super well, and it was not necessarily the peak of what you could do at the time. It was just that it's so hyper-stylized that the limitations of their execution of these things probably didn't bother people as much. I think notably, the first real big hiccup is the wolf. That video game wolf thing with the terrible hair rendering that does not comport well with what you could do in 2006. If you were, you know, ILM or Weta or Sony Pictures Imageworks or anything like that, like it doesn't sit well with what was possible. But because this movie is so hyper stylized, I believe it was forgiven for that. Its stark contrast, which crushed all of the blacks, really helped sell the fact that was a wolf with glowing eyes. And you see that repeated throughout this movie, where there's some stuff that just is flat and weird and doesn't work as well. There are other things that they execute, you know, to a decent enough degree. I have to say the predominant digital effects in this movie are not creatures or the skies, but really the heavy treatment of everything. This movie has a lot of post-processing going on to make it look like this very bleach bypassed, like heavily desaturated, oftentimes sepia, glowy, bloomed, clipped highlight thing that you don't really associate with these sorts of movies, and you probably in your recollection of the film don't think of, but if you were to sit down and watch it, as unfortunately you and I just did, you get to see the ways in which all the sort of graphical information is crushed on the low end and just spiked to the high heavens on the high end. And how that would also comport with what Zack Snyder would go on to do with his other projects.
Yeah, I was going to say, stylistically, yeah, it is real heavy, and that's what they were going for. And you can tell that that's what they were going for from the get-go, because clearly they did tests, and they were smart enough to realize, like, oh, you can't read anybody's eyeballs unless we put a really bright eye light in everybody's eyeballs. So they just had these sort of, like, black irises, but with one, like, pinging white highlight in everyone's eye, which is, it's a good thing they did that, because you wouldn't be able to see anyone's eyes if they didn't. But it's actually kind of a cool look that you don't really see, because nobody would do that. And it would have been great if everyone had seen this movie and gone like, wow, that was visually pretty interesting, and that there's some new stuff that they've done in there. I guess I'll go back to making movies the way most people make movies now, instead of saying I can do that but more and better, and then we just beat this style into the ground for the next, I don't know, probably 5 years. I think the good news about this style is that it wore on us so quickly that the trend ramped up and burned out very quickly for most people. I mean, you know, Zack Snyder not permitting, but yeah, you know, a lot of people decided to try this, and maybe they shouldn't so much have, but I liked it at the time. It's interesting. I think it works for, I shouldn't say it works for. This movie is all style and very little substance. So the more style you throw at it, the better it can be. Like, you know, it's dismissive and diminutive to say, like, this movie is a cinematography demo reel for, like, phantom cameras and color correction visual effects facilities. But, like, you know, the camera guys really got to, like, stretch their legs, and they're, you know, they're probably cracking their knuckles going like, all right, let's get down to it. Like, how fast does this camera go? And, you know, the VFX guys are probably like, all right, like, how far can we push these god rays coming through, these arrows coming through and stuff? Like, you know, they really got to, like, test the limits of stuff, which, you know, it also pushes the boundaries of good taste. And you should probably, like, you know, when it looks like it's too much, you back it off a little bit. Like, it's just, it should mostly be barely noticeable what you're doing. But this whole movie really wanted to see how much you could push the style before the visuals broke. And I think, you know, sort of the overarching feeling of the movie comes from the style, because really we have a prolonged 2-day battle scene that is vaguely kind of based on historical events, but isn't really accurate. And then they threw a bunch of, like, weird monsters and disfigured things going on in there. And, a lot of just sort of exaggeration, which, and I don't want to like internet reply guy myself automatically, but, like, you know, well, it's a guy telling a story about a battle that he wasn't at, and it's really about him, you know, prolonging the mythos of this king to, you know, rally his troops or whatever. Cause that's actually, like, the narration underneath this is, like, being told to troops a year later about how great their king was and, you know, how he died for honor and his family and blah, blah, blah. Now you got to redeem him and stuff. So, like, you know, you can excuse all of the sins of the logic of this movie based on the fact that it's a guy in, you know, 480 BC telling a story to other soldiers before they go fight people. But still, like, it's not the most interesting fighting tactics or anything. It's just like, how badass, I'm doing air quotes, how badass can we make this fight with super slow-mo and, like, absurdly fit buff dudes in, you know, little leather crotch underwears with capes and, you know, scarred bronze helmets. And, you know, it's like they really just, like, went for it. Like, it's a 2-hour long badass music video about people in ancient Greece fighting ancient Persians.
Yeah, it's since you touched on slow-mo, we should really talk about that, because wow, this movie, it is surprising how many times during a slow-mo sequence in a battle that I would look at the remaining time left in the film. I don't remember, well, of course, I didn't do that in a movie theater when I saw it, because obviously you couldn't, it was impossible, but it doesn't seem engaging now, and I wonder if it ever was really engaging, or if it was just that nobody else was slowing things down as extremely, that maybe that was interesting.
This was that period of time where the technology had gotten to the point where you're like, look what we can do, and some people were like, interesting, let's try some stuff. But yeah, I think part of it is we hadn't seen it, but yeah, the other part of it was like, who would choose to do that?
Yeah, because there's some really dramatic stuff that happens that's mainly Tyler Bates's score that's happening, and, you know, the sort of thunderous, raucous thing that's happening while you're seeing things barely move across screen, and you're like, I guess this is dramatic.
How do you make a bullet time movie when there's no bullets? You just got spears and swords and stuff.
Yes, it's a spear time movie.
That's a flavor of gum. And I remember seeing some of the behind the scenes stuff back then, because there's that one scene where they're sort of tracking along as Leonidas is like charging forward, and, you know, he's doing the spear stuff, and then he throws the spear, and then he pulls out the sword, and then he stabs a bunch of people, and he pulls the spear back out, and they're doing that sort of like crash zoom but also slow-mo stuff. And at the time it was like, how did you do that? That's like kind of on top of the slow-mo, it's kind of nutso that you're doing this speed ramping stuff in these three different focal lengths. Like, what is that? And it was just them, like, they put three cameras on a dolly all at different focal lengths, and they just kind of merged them all in post and just crash zoomed between them in post, which was, again, style. Like, how many tricks can you throw at this thing to make it look as cool as possible? Because, you know, I don't know that we needed that. I guess they play into it a little bit, the story of, you know, Leonidas and the wolf there, and then at the end there when he drops his helmet and his shield and stuff, about how it's like the heightened sense of things or whatever. Maybe that's supposed to just be like, you know, his brain is moving 10 times faster than all the other people because he's such a great warrior or whatever, and like this is how he navigates through, like he's the Flash or whatever, like everyone else is moving in slow motion around him as he kills everybody. But, you know, there's a lot of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, unfortunately became, I think, a crutch or a signature style of his, this reliance on speed ramping. And it was something that he used in Watchmen again, with Night Owl and Silk Spectre during the jail breakout scene. Their speed ramps up and down as they're punching people.
It is definitely a way to cover Hollywood punches that don't land and make them look more violent when you're shooting like everything in a wide master. Like there's even a scene in this movie where even their best like speed ramp around it, like it's a wide shot with Fassbender and the kid that gets his head cut off, and you can see like, oh, none of these punches or sword hits are actually landing anywhere near people, but they're speed ramping and hoping you don't notice that.
Yeah, well, I think mainly if this had been fast, you probably wouldn't have noticed it. I think it's mainly the drama of the speed ramp that distracts you from the unfortunate error of the speed ramp, which shows you how slow things are happening. It's sort of like a double-edged sword, if you will, of they slow it down so that you see the drama of things, but at the same time, you see that things don't actually connect. Whereas if things were moving quickly, you would see that things appear to connect because you've moved on to the next part. So I think that's just slightly different. But we've talked a lot about style here, and we should probably talk about some of the, here's me looking at the bottom of a barrel, substance that is perhaps in this movie. Because this is a movie that I don't think really had a lot of thought in what they were doing. And the thoughts that they had were mainly homophobic, racist, xenophobic, etc. Not really good thoughts put together in good ways.
I feel like they probably just said, what is the comic show? Do that. I don't know that they probably put a whole lot more thought into it than that, other than like, make the dudes buffer, make the monsters weirder, make it cooler, make it sexier, whatever what kind of nonsense a director would say to people to try and, like, again, turn those knobs up to 11 at all times.
Yeah, I mean, because, like, here's a quote from Frank Miller. The inaccuracies, almost all of them, are intentional. I took the chest plates and leather skirts off of them for a reason. I want these guys to move, and I wanted them to look good. I knocked their helmets off a fair amount, partly so you can recognize who the characters are. Spartans in full regalia are almost indistinguishable, except at a close angle. Another liberty I took was they all had plumes, but I only gave a plume to Leonidas to make him stand out and identify him as a king. I was looking for an evocation, then a history lesson? It's not really a sentence. I don't know what that is. The best result I can hope for is that the movie excites someone. They'll explore the histories themselves because the histories are endlessly fascinating. And, you know, that's something you can say, because whenever you're taking something that is historical, especially something from so very long ago, you are making an adaptation. Even modern day adaptations take liberties with things. They combine historical people that existed as two separate people into a single person in order to economically tell a story, or they invent another person that didn't exist in order to hold a part that's missing from the rest of the story in order to tell a coherent narrative in a short amount of time. So that's not necessarily a knock about those things, but there is a criticism, let's say, about Snyder, with Snyder himself dismissed ideological readings, suggesting that viewers who critique a graphical novel about a bunch of guys stomping the snot out of each other using words like neocon, homophobic, homoerotic, or racist are missing the point. Doesn't elaborate what the point is. Snyder also admitted to fashioning an effeminate villain specifically to make young straight males in the audience uncomfortable. What's more scary to a 20-year-old boy than a giant god king who wants to have his way with you? I find that a little not good, you know, because there's no specific reason for that. And if you were to look at the histories of these things, like this Persian king Xerxes, who is attacking, and Sparta, who is defending, it's not as binary as it appears to be. These countries all attacked and repelled each other all the time. This movie paints it as Sparta being freedom and democracy, and your ability as a man to do the stuff. Whereas
standing up for what's right.
Yes. Whereas Persia is depicted as following lockstep with a leader and doing what he says, because it will get you money or riches or other earthly pleasures, and that is bad.
It's all drug, sex, and gold and Caligula over there. Which
Caligula wasn't born yet, Dan.
Well, you know, he's setting the example, apparently.
Yeah, but it's not as binary as that, because Sparta has its own problems. Like, Sparta had slaves. The beginning of this movie even is depicting what happens to children who are born who do not meet certain criteria. They're killed. That's not good. And then the one child who isn't killed, who survives because his parents lived in exile, he is depicted in a very poor manner, because it is compelling to depict people who are not as good as being physically physically different from you, and that is a reason to push them away. Had Leonidas accepted this, the other character who suffered from disease, suffered from some skeletal issues that would have repelled him from the Spartan society. Society. if he had just been like, yeah, sure, whatever, hang out in the back, like.
Well, he told him to, you know, help clear the field of wounded and give people water, but the guy, you know, he had been taught the Spartan way that it's fight or nothing. But yeah, I know what you're saying. It's a little, Master Racy, isn't it?
It's incredibly Master Racy. I don't understand. It's like, yes, we have freedom, but our freedom is based purely on whether or not we deem you to be a free person, and that's controlled by these men who may exile you for a certain period of time until you kill a wolf in the hills for some reason, and
just to toughen you up.
Yeah, and our women are incredibly strong, but they're mainly incredibly strong in the kind of way where you'd be like, hello, wife, thank you for making a 7-layer bean dip for the Super Bowl party. Like, that is kind of the celebratory nature of, like, how they participate in the society. It is weird, this depiction of things. How that is good, and the Persians are evil, because the Persians are shown to be living an excessive lifestyle, that there are physical differences between them and basically what you would consider to be the norms. There are differences in terms of sexual preference or the gender depiction of certain people. Like, it is weird. Like, there is that like strange orgy scene in Xerxes' tent where there are two women kissing, and it's just like, okay, so that's evil that they're kissing, like, I guess, maybe, I don't know, but
it's a circus freak show of like deformed people doing drugs and having sex, and anything goes.
Yeah, but that's awful, I guess, to
yeah,
paint
it's
your...
not great. There's a big long section on Wikipedia about how Iran was really not happy with a lot of that stuff.
No, I mean, as you probably would imagine, beyond that, I think it is also just fuel for the fire for mainly what we might consider to be people who view themselves as masculine.
To quote myself from the Slack earlier, this is porn for cops. This is Blue Lives Matter porn right here. Like, you know, people who think that they're going to be, I am the man who is going to draw the line in the sand and be honorable and fight tooth and nail until my last dying breath and die with honor because I am a good person and the enemy is bad. Things are only black and white in the world, and I am only good and everyone else is only bad. People who have that sort of mentality love this movie, I'm sure, because that's the underlying thing here. It's setting up a society based entirely on strength and masculinity and honor, and not talking about feelings, and all you got to do is fight and protect the homeland to be a good, honorable person, king, soldier, man, TV camera thing.
Also, so, you have to be a physically perfect specimen of a human being,
right? Or they throw you off a mountain.
Yeah,
unless of course you're a disease-ridden wise person that lives in the hills that just, I don't know, has like opium burning all the time and takes advantage of young girls, apparently.
Yeah, I'm just gonna say that whole scene with them didn't make a ton of sense. I am not well versed, however, in the historical inaccuracies of that. I will just say
there's a very large section of historical inaccuracies on the Wikipedia page if you want to read about it. I mean, it's fair to say that the ancient Greek society was probably fairly unevolved and barbaric compared to modern sensibilities. So any and everything probably is like on the table in terms of like how low are you willing to go with depictions of certain things in this movie. It's
how
not going to be accurate.
Can you go?
It's it's not going to be accurate. It's not going to be palatable to a modern audience, but you pick and choose your things based on what you think is going to make the audience feel a certain way. And, you know, they want us to think that Gerard Butler is a strong, honorable man who's only trying to protect his people and his country. And the Persians are bad because they're greedy and they want subservience from everyone because they believe themselves to be better than everyone for no particular reason. And society built on strong people is going to give them what for and show them who really is tough. And it's interesting how much it parallels Thanos in Marvel, because, you know, the whole, all that for a drop of blood, you know, if you can make God bleed, people will stop believing in him. Like those are from the Iron Man things, but that's basically the premise here is Leonidas knows he's going to die, but he's going to show people that this dude ain't no God King. And I'm going to cut his face with a spear to sort of demoralize him and the troops a little bit and sort of show that, no, you're just a crazy person who wants our stuff and you can't have it.
Yeah.
Or even if you can have it, it's, you know, for the wrong reasons.
Yeah. So I guess we're saying this movie is an abomination.
we're saying this movie is, I think we've already put in as much thought about this movie as was necessary to create it. From a story standpoint, I should say, there's a lot of thought going into, you know, getting your grain right and your LUTs right. And, your curves, swoopy enough so that the contrast is crunched, but,
and your diffusion was bloomed just wide enough that, it fills a certain amount of the frame.
Yes. But there are other things to talk about. For me, this was, I think, the first time I had seen Gerard Butler. And I think every instance after this that I saw him, I was like, oh, that's that guy? Really? He's doing, he looks like that and he's doing that now? Because he's, you know, he's got the big old pokey chin beard here and the big fluffy mustachey thing going on. He's very buff and, you know, mostly unclothed most of the time. There are two things I could say about this movie. I think this movie is the perfect movie for Gerard Butler and the perfect movie for Zack Snyder because it highlights their strengths.
It highlights
very
their
well.
Complete emptiness. But
you know, yeah. Is it wrong to say they're really good at something that you may not like? Like I think they did this movie as well as it could have been done. It's just, it's not a thing that most people really care for, especially 15 years later. But Gerard Butler, you know, this was a role for him. He looked pensive. He screamed at things. He was intimidating. You know, he fit that costume well. He handled his swords and spears well. Like, I don't know what to say. Like, he was a presence that looked like he could be a leader of this group here.
At what point? I think this is more a situation where the costume fits you rather than you fit the costume.
Oh, because it's just leather underwear?
Yes.
I mean, but like,
he's wearing a leather Speedo and a red cape and occasionally a helmet through most of this movie. And the rest of the time you're staring at his abs and nipples. So that's not much of a costume.
Yeah. Yeah, but like, you know, he became this character, I think. I think, aside from the Scottish accent, I think he became a good King Leonidas for all of the aforementioned shallow values that his character was supposed to represent. You know, the something something Cliff Notes honor, and I'm going to go stab people until they realize that we're honorable. I think he did that really well in this movie. Like, you know, again, his level of success in doing what he was trying to do, I think, is very high.
Yeah, I mean, I think this really put him on the map, his commitment to doing this, such as it is. I think prior to that, we've only discussed Tomorrow Never Dies, where he was leading seamen on the HMS Devonshire at the beginning of the film. And
Wait, what?
Yeah, he was leading seamen. You heard it here first, folks. This Gerard Butler was leading seaman.
Like, what the hell are you talking about? Is he sneaking in to plant some DNA on a boat or something? No. Anyway.
Okay.
You don't have to spell.
And then he was apparently in Dracula 2000, which I've never seen, but is sort of infamous, I guess.
Is that the one with James Woods?
Sure.
Hmm.
I don't know. Actually, I never saw it. I think it has Jerry Ryan
Dracula
in it.
Dracula 2000.
Christopher Plummer, Johnny Lee Miller, Vitamin C, holy crap, Omar Epps, Sean Patrick Thomas, Danny Masterson, yuck. Jerry Ryan.
I have not seen this. What's the one I'm thinking of where, what's his name? I just said his name and now I already forgot.
He's a vampire thing. I don't remember what it is either.
Oh, isn't it just called Vampires or something?
Sure. Gerard Butler. Yeah.
There you go.
Was also the Phantom in the Phantom of the Opera in 2004, which is 2 years prior to this,
I was completely unaware of until you brought it to my attention.
Yes, because that is your buddy Joel Schumacher. He did that one, and then you got 300, I think, which was his big breakout, and that he went on to do a bunch of garbage. Including The Ugly Truth with Katherine Heigl when she was doing all those rom-coms in the late 2000s.
I have seen a portion of that, at least. I don't know about all of it.
It's pretty dreadful, in my opinion.
It's another one where he's leaning into, I am chauvinistic male, but maybe I can change?
Yeah.
Oh, God, gamer, law-abiding citizen. This is where he starts to hit the low point. Bounty Hunter, goodness. Anyway, and then there were all of the Blank Has Fallen movies that he's in. I think he did three of those.
London Has Fallen. What are the other Has Fallens?
Olympus and Angel.
Is he in those? I don't see him credited as that.
He in 2013 he was in Olympus Has Fallen, the first one. 2016 London Has Fallen was the second one, and most recently 2019 Angel Has Fallen is his movie. It's about his character, so he's not just sort of like the sidekick to the president.
He fell.
Yeah. They framed him or something. They took away his reputation as an honorable man.
I did not realize he became such an establishment that we cared about him as much as we cared about the White House or. London, but sure. I guess that's something.
See what happens when you take away a man's dignity and accuse him of being a traitor when he's really an honorable man. I bet he blows some stuff up to defend his name.
Yeah, he was also in Geostorm. We should watch Geostorm someday.
I've heard of that. Is that like The Day After Tomorrow, but something else?
It's like The Core, I guess, is what I've mainly heard it. Framed as.
Have I seen this? I don't think I have. That's a real fake looking. Oh, that's Dubai. That's Dubai?
Sure. No, I don't know, Dan. I haven't seen it. But the important part here is that this helped, I guess, with Gerard Butler. And of course, Lena Headey, who is his wife in this, the queen, she would go on to be super hyper famous for her roles on Game of Thrones as the evil queen lady who slept with their brother and then like ascended to the throne and all that jazz. So she's famous for that. And she was in Dread, which we watched as the crime boss lady.
I liked her in Dread.
Yeah. And you don't really notice her. And then there is, of course, Michael Fassbender, who is in this movie. And you're just like, what?
Like, I remembered all of these faces of people who haven't necessarily gone on to do a ton of other stuff. I did not remember that Fassbender was in this movie.
No, I had completely forgotten about that one. I remembered the guy Faramir, who is the narrator dude, the one-eyed narrator dude. He played Faramir in the Return of the King, I want to say. Of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and he's done some other things, but he mainly has this sort of like breathy, like very authoritative voice. So I guess he's very well suited for being your narrator of 300.
Does he talk like that in the other movie too?
He has a manner of speaking which is distinct.
Is that a yes?
Yes, I guess. I don't know. He's okay. Not the narrator of the other film, but he's very briefly in it.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, you got a lot of... Got a lot of Abby dudes in here. A lot of dudes spend a lot of time doing sit-ups and things.
Yeah, I just like to picture like a bunch of monks doing sit-ups. So when you say Abby dudes, mm-hmm. No, I mean, you know, they had some like really super extreme physical regimen that they had to go through, and I believe, if I remember correctly, from the time in which the promotional materials were being distributed for this, Zack Snyder himself went through the same procedure as he was putting these actors through.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how
incredibly
closely...
incredibly Michael Bay thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, he's like a Michael Bay-ish sort of thing, I guess. Sort of, kind of.
I think he's Michael Bay with less irony, if that's possible.
Yeah, a more sincere Michael Bay. How does that sound?
A little less sarcasm, a little less irony, and then you get Zack Snyder. Mm. Yeah. But again, I mean, you know, I'm struggling to fully grasp like what it actually felt like to see this movie in a theater new in 2006, which I'm pretty sure I did, because this movie made a lot of money, and I think it was one of those movies that people just said, like, I don't know, man, you got to go see this thing because it's kind of not like anything you've seen before. And it left an impression of, again, a milestone of cinema that they really went for it in this one direction. And I think they achieved the goals that they were attempting to achieve by almost every metric. And then it was just all downhill after this movie. You know, the sequel, the spinoff, the parodies, the slow-mo.
Yeah, I thought at the time that it was sort of a breakthrough of sorts, I guess. I for some reason, I own the 300 motion picture soundtrack from Tyler Bates. The score for this movie is not actually very good, so I don't know why I did that, but I have it. So, you know, people are capable of changing their opinions over time, I suppose. But yeah, this movie, upon revisiting, is hot toxic waste, and I just cannot stress that enough, that whatever feelings I may have had about the stylistic bombast of this at the time, I do not enjoy it in its present state in the year 2020. I cannot possibly condone anybody push this forward into the future as something that is cinema, that is meant for consumption and regurgitation, and inspiration for things. Like, this is trash.
Mm. It's I don't know if you would even call it a popcorn film, because it has its I was going to say it has its slow periods where, you know, it gets thoughtful and philosophical, but really it's just, you know, slow motion at nighttime with more close-ups. You know, I think it's worth, if you can watch this movie in a safe mental space of 2020, sort of saying like, this movie should be wholly contextualized in the sort of unnecessary hyper masculine toxic masculinity nonsense that we absolutely do not need more of right now, then okay, you can watch it for that purpose. But if you get sucked into this movie, and like, if you come out of this movie with like an urge to go take kickboxing lessons or something, like, you've done something wrong. Please stop.
Yeah. If you subscribe to the Joe Rogan podcast after watching this movie, no, you did the wrong thing. You didn't experience this movie correctly.
If you're thinking to yourself, I wonder if I could wield a spear that well, stop and go listen to some NPR or something. Calm yourself down and become a more evolved human being. But for what it is, for like this, you know, this violent action movie from 2006, like, it's, again, it did a lot of interesting stuff. But yeah, we don't we don't need to hold this up as some sort of like, you know, that movie that, you know, did all the things right and was a pillar of cinema at a period of time. Like, you know, it was interesting. It was definitely a standout, but we've moved past this. Like, let's move past it.
Yeah, it's not something that has any staying power. You know what does have staying power, though?
Hmm.
Stephen McCady, who was the loyalist member of the council in Sparta.
Real guy?
Yeah, he was council. He was Senator Vrenek in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. He's the guy who holds up the Isolinear rod and he says, "This is a fake. It's a fake."
He looks like he could be a Star Trek.
He was a Star Trek. So he was good in that. I just thought I would mention that for you as part of my prerequisite.
Apparently, he was in Watchmen.
What was he in Watchmen?
Somebody named Hollis Mason.
Oh, yes. That's the first Night Owl.
Oh, okay.
There is the first Night Owl who writes the book about crime fighting, and then there's the second Night Owl who is what's his face? He Patrick Wilson, and he is the one who is in the movie and who has sex to Hallelujah with the second mm-hmm. Silk Spectre, who is not the first Silk Spectre either.
Can you draw any conclusions about what Zack Snyder is like in the bedroom between this movie and that movie?
I dare not.
Boy.
Yeah. So
now everyone's thinking about it.
It's weird though. Considering this movie is an hour and 47-ish minutes or something.
57.
Oh, boy. And how it felt like time stopped every time I would go to check to see how much was left and how many slow-motion battles were still going on. Mm-hmm. It is weird to actually have wrapped up talking about it 51 minutes into this podcast, a podcast where we are infamous for nearly going the runtime or over the runtime of every film we talk about. Let that be a lesson to you if you are thinking that perhaps this movie contains really rich treasures that we haven't tapped into. It's just possibly not there.
Do you want to delve into the subtext of the relationship between Leonidas and his wife, or the politics of the time and how the council was supposed to uphold the laws in a democratic way, but was subjected to bribery from Xerxes by way of gold and such? And no, it's not really necessary. Did this movie in what's his name's description of it, did this make you actually want to look up what actually happened at the Battle of Thermopylae at all?
Not really, because you kind of get a good summary from the controversies section of Wikipedia.
I found it interesting. There's also some interesting, classic art, you know, depictions of the Battle of Thermopylae, which is kind of interesting. There's a, what is this painting in here that's on Wikipedia? Jacques Louis David or something? I don't know. Anyway, it's a lot of Renaissance style art, and it's a, again, it's a story, it's a parable, whatever, this whole idea, it's like ye olde Blue Lives Matter kind of thing. Like, it's the OG, like, if you're an honorable man standing up for what you believe in, look what you can accomplish with your smarts and your weaponry kind of stuff. Mm. And, you know, that's kind of what a lot of historical fiction is about. So it's an interesting story, and I want to read more. I read some of it again, and I remembered some of this, but like, you know, it makes you want to look back at ancient Greece a little bit here and there, but it didn't do much for you, did it?
No, not really. Surprising in some respects, because I thought I would be able to mine more from this that I perhaps enjoyed or liked or something, but man, revisiting it really puts a damper on any ability to think fondly of anything about it, because it is just gross in so many ways.
Well, again, it was that period of time where, like, we had not seen this combination of technique and style. If you're not like sitting back on a couch, if you're in a theater and you get sucked into this, like, you forget that like this is dumb and nothing has happened. Like, This is like, you know, it's like a violent version of the Thong Song. You go back and look at it and you're like, what is this video? What is happening here? And how was this popular culture back then? But you're like, well, you know, it's a thing that happened. We don't have to carry that forward with us into 2020. But like, we were really going for it as a culture back then. And like, let's leave that where it is. But anyway. Do you remember the video for the Thong Song?
Vaguely.
Yeah, you should watch it. It's like the 300 of Miami Beach.
Oh, I nearly choked on my water when you were telling me that.
Sorry. I didn't intend to nearly kill you.
Yeah. Oh boy. Yeah, it's just yeah, I don't got anything else for this, but I would like to celebrate our 300th episode in some other way.
Sure.
Because we, you know, put a lot into this, at least 299 other things.
We're here to think critically about 300 so you don't have to.
Yeah, and that's the kind of service we provide on a weekly basis. We look at a movie and we say, yeah, sure, why not? And we talk about it and we're like... Yeah,
sure, why not?
There's some stuff. I mean, mainly what happens is about somewhere between Sunday and Tuesday, there is a heated Slack thread where I'm sending you messages about like different things we could possibly watch and like why they're all bad, and then eventually we settle on one of them because it's free. And that's how we mainly do things most of the time.
And we're always our own worst enemy, because 2 days later we hit play on the movie and we're like, why the hell did we pick this movie? What was the logic? I guess it was easy, but now we have to, you know, you have to live with the repercussions of your decisions.
Yeah. I mean, if we put a considerable amount more effort into our planning or did more research into things where we were actually well versed on the topics we were discussing, whether or not we liked them, then I think that would perhaps make for a different podcast. But this is not that. This is decidedly not that.
Our commentary needs to be filtered through the lens of our own personal experience. We're not here to, as often as we do read the internet, we're not here to relay Wikipedia information to you. We're here to give our own completely misguided, slanted opinion about things.
Yes, and we also do not necessarily always recap every moment of the film.
No.
Yeah.
To be honest, I'm glad we kind of like have not done that for a while, because it's better to sort of just talk about these things. And also for this movie, my God, what would we have said?
Could you imagine?
Cool,
we'd be like,
how cool was it when he made that rock wall with the bodies in there and stuff? And then there's the, you know, there's the wide shot where you can't tell. And then there's the close-up shot where you're like, look at all them bodies with flies and stuff.
Yeah, and then we'd be like, yeah, so the spear is still traveling across frame right now. So what do you feel about the spear on the frame that we're looking at this moment? And then the spear as it appears right now before it hits the guy, and then the spear when it hits the guy. Like, mm-hmm. What is your thought process from one to the other?
On a scale from 1 to 420, how good was that guy's Cheech Marin impression before he got his arm cut off? Anyway, yeah.
We have fun.
Yeah. 300 episodes.
Mm-hmm. 300.
Honestly, that number sounds less impressive than six years. It was 6 years. We just did the anniversary of this. I should know the 6 years.
Yes.
That, you know, 6 years sounds longer than 300 episodes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's 52 episodes per year. So,
I mean, if you listen to one episode a day of our podcast, God knows why you would do that. That's not even a year's worth of content right there.
No, not yet. It will be soon. Another year.
Another year. After 7 years, we've created 1 year's worth of content. Maybe then we'll finally retire.
I guess. I don't know. I mean, I have fun talking to you. I like talking to you. It is always good to talk to you, regardless of what the subject matter is.
oh, boy. Like Cuban sandwiches and tacos.
Remember when we used to talk about shame burritos?
I do remember. That's still our Twitter header image, isn't it? Shame burrito.
Yeah.
Yeah, we used to have memes. Remember in the first little while? I mean, there was, you know, the podcast world was different back then too, but we had fans and fan art and memes and t-shirts.
Remember Cats Per Mango?
I do. That was Age of Ultron, right?
Yeah, that was Age of Ultron.
I don't remember. We somehow just got on the topic of CPMs and somebody made a joke. It was probably you. It wouldn't have been me.
I think I may have said it, but I think your continued riffing and then we spun it into something. Because as is often the case, one of us will say something and then the other one will, bat it around a little bit.
It's called improv.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, there's not a situation where one of us is a single author of this podcast. So I think it is a collaborative process. And we certainly, I would like to blame you in part, at least for Cats Per Mango in some way, though I don't know what it is.
Mm. As a resident of Arizona, I feel very comfortable taking the blame for nearly anything, so I'm fine with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. As a resident of California, I feel fine blaming people, so that's good for me.
How dare you sit in judgment with your progressive liberal ideals? I'm just a simple desert person over here who just wants to be left to my own devices, and why do you have to... I don't know, something virtue signaling, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Well, what you need to do is get your other desert people together in a pass between California and Arizona. I don't know, like needles or whatever.
I'm joking on water. it will be known on Wikipedia as the Battle of Blythe. We will force everyone into a two-lane, we'll call it a border control stopping point, and we will defeat you there, where it comes down to the one lane. Because you can't go through the lanes with the red light, because that's against the rules. You got to go through the one with the green light, and we will defeat you. Your numbers will count for nothing.
Yes, yes.
California outnumbers our population 3-1, but that's good odds for any Venetian.
I mean, mainly you could just cut off our electricity, but whatever you want to do.
You could pull a Matrix, whichever one that was, and do a backflip off a motorcycle into the power plant out there in Palo Verde.
Yeah, or maybe we could surprise everybody and have a peace treaty where we sit down over barbecue in somewhere in Blythe and
hash it out. Oh, actually, Blythe does have a barbecue place.
Yeah,
across from the McDonald's.
I saw it on Yelp.
We don't go there though. No, go to the McDonald's or go to Taco Bell. Like, get something safe. Get a chain that you can sue if you get violently ill.
I mean, I'm not going to eat in Blythe. That's my feeling on that one. But for making peace,
Olive Garden in Moreno Valley. I have.
Why did you do that?
It's a long story and it wasn't my decision.
You were in Moreno Valley and you were like, you know what I need right now? Endless soup and salad.
We had to get out of town in a hurry because somebody had had their fill of Los Angeles. And by the time we got to Moreno Valley, that person was hungry. And it was decided that we needed to stop. And there was like a Del Taco and there was an Olive Garden and we wanted to sit down.
Well, I mean... I can hardly blame you. Given the option between Del Taco and Olive Garden, I would go with Olive Garden.
I think there's also a Bob's Big Boy out there, but I don't think I've ever eaten at a Bob's Big Boy.
I haven't either. There's that the somewhat famous one in Burbank on like Olive or whatever it is. I have seen that one depicted many times.
It's got the big the dude with the thing.
Mm-hmm. Bob's Big Boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I have not eaten it, but I should, I guess, at some point, as being a California resident.
Yeah, just cruise up to Burbank, pick up a burger or two.
It's so far.
Yeah.
What are you gonna
do? Where are you getting your burgers these days? Anybody got artisanal takeout burgers?
Well, most recently I went to Firestone on Washington Boulevard, and I picked up, we had burgers there, but in the alfresco situation that they had, it was. But I do not recommend that for all peoples who are capable of, not being as susceptible to things. I don't think that's a good idea, necessarily, because we saw some guys who... After we sat down, they walked into the bathroom in the indoor facility without actually wearing a mask. and we're not reprimanded by anyone, and then went back to the table and sat down. And I was like, well, that's probably a bad sign that you have people moving about in an uncontrolled fashion in this environment.
Mm. Well, because of that, I will continue to boycott this place that I've never heard of, because to me, Firestone is a tire and or a beer.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is a beer place.
It's a brewery. Is this the titular Firestone Brewery?
Yes. No, I mean, it is one of them. They have like three, I guess.
Sure. They're probably headquartered in the Midwest, you know, for tax purposes.
No, I think their headquarters were originally in Paso Robles. They have another location somewhere else, and then they have this one called the Propagator in Venice, which is on Washington Boulevard, and that's the one.
Oh, look at that. You're right, Paso Robles.
Huh. Yeah. And that's the, I mean, it is owned by the Firestone Tire Air or whatever.
Adam Firestone.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. Who was on like The Bachelor or something? I don't know.
Oh, this guy looks unpleasant.
He doesn't seem nice. But
I bet he likes 300.
There are beers that they have there for your various beers and ales that you could have. And we hadn't been in a while. We went to French fries, and we just made a poor choice in deciding to dine al fresco when there are other people out in the world who are not as careful about things.
Damn it. I got to take it back. I apologize to the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company founded in August 1900 in Akron, Ohio.
Is that because they're founded in Akron, Ohio, that you're taking it back?
I'm from Akron. I'm not allowed to talk bad about that. It's rubber capital of the world. I knew the Goodyear company was there, and that's where they keep the blimp and stuff. But apparently Firestone started there, too, which I guess makes sense. It wouldn't really be the rubber capital of the world if it was only one tire company.
Yeah, I'm sorry about your sin against rubber.
My sin against rubber? Wow. I just clicked on the Akron. You know how many... The current population of Akron?
200,000?
Just under 200,000 people. That is very small.
That was a good guess, I guess.
198,000 in 2018. So you got, well, are we assuming population has gone up in the past 2 years or down? Because it is Ohio.
I don't know. Anyway. I'm assuming down because there are tires being made abroad.
The factories are all... I'm pretty sure they're all gone and abandoned at this point.
Oh, okay.
There's no industry in Ohio anymore. It's just sad people and alcoholics. Including my family. Hey-o!
Speaking of sad people and alcoholics, we should probably wrap up this episode.
Wait, which one are we?
Why can't we be both? Two great tastes that taste great together.
Sadness and alcoholism. Oh, boy. All right. All right, well, yeah, I guess we will button this one up.
Mm-hmm. So,
cheers to another 300.
Yes, yes.
Not the movie. We don't need another one of those. Talking about podcasts.
No, definitely not. To another 300, Dan. Bye.
Goodbye.